This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. This week, Leah Uppi joins us to talk about indignity, her powerful new book about her grandmother's life under fascism, war, and dictatorship, and what it means to hold on to dignity in an age of extremes. Then, in her novel Fireflies in Winter, Eleanor Shearer takes us into the world of the Jamaican Maroons exiled to Nova Scotia after the Second Maroon War. It's a sweeping historical novel about displacement, queer love, and the moral cost of survival. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station at writersvoice.net or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Leah Uppi grew up in Albania during the collapse of communism, an experience she explored in her acclaimed memoir, Free. But in her powerful new book, Indignity, A Life Reimagined, Uppi turns back two generations to her grandmother, Lehman, and to a life shaped by empire, fascism, war, displacement, and dictatorship. What begins with a single haunting photograph becomes a sweeping, intimate journey through the violent upheavals of the 20th century and a meditation on what it means to live with dignity when history seems determined to strip it away. Part history, part memoir, and part fiction, Indignity asks some of the most urgent questions of our time. Who gets to tell the story of the past? How do power and surveillance shape our lives? And how do ordinary people hold on to their moral compass in an age of extremes? Leah Uppi is a professor of political theory at the London School of Economics and a leading voice on freedom, democracy, and authoritarianism. Let's listen now. Leah Uppi, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Everything in this book begins with that haunting honeymoon photograph from 1941, your grandmother's honeymoon. It's on the cover of the book. Take us back to the moment you first saw it. What was going on?
So the photo was shared on social media by someone I had never met before and hadn't heard the name of before. And within minutes of being posted, it became viral. And it was a photo of my grandmother that I had also not seen before, clearly taken from her honeymoon, which was in a ski resort. And I'd heard lots of stories about this honeymoon because she would tell me. But I had also been told that all records of my grandmother's youth disappeared when the communist governments that had come to power in Albania at the end of World War II arrested my grandfather and took all their personal belongings. And so it was a great surprise to find this photo online, shared by a stranger. And then there were lots of derogatory comments, people who were alleging that my grandmother had been a spy. Some people said she'd been a communist spy or a fascist spy. Some people said she'd been both. And for me, it raised this question of dignity because, first of all, from a personal perspective, one of the things that my grandmother always said when she discussed her life, which had been a life of ups and downs and great tragedy and loss starting from a position of privilege, was that she had lost everything, you know, money, wealth, family connections. But the one thing she never lost was dignity. And for me, seeing the photo of a relative shared online with all these derogatory comments by people who didn't know her raised the question of what is the dignity of someone who is no longer there to defend their legacy? And in a way, started me off on a search for things that I didn't know about my grandmother's life, because I also thought that although I really felt this urge to somehow protect her from these insults online, there were clearly parts of this life that I didn't know and those who had shared the photo had access to. And so there was this trading between, on the one hand, the urge to find the truth of this life in order to defend the legacy of this person and to reconstruct that life in a way that would give it dignity. But then on the other hand, also the uncertainty and the fact that all of this would be done with incomplete information and navigating, on the one hand, family stories, but on the other hand, things that would come out from sources that I had no idea existed. And that's where the book really starts. And that's why it's an investigation into both the personal but also the political meaning of dignity in this time of great upheaval and through the tragedies of the 20th century.
And you are a political philosopher, so when you talk about dignity and indignity, it may have a deeper meaning than many people just assume when they use the word. We usually think of dignity as something that people either have or they lose. What is dignity to you?
Well, I think of it as a property that is really what makes us human. I always think that one of the things that distinguishes humans as beings with reason from other species is the fact that they have a kind of reflexive capacity and that they have a kind of internal freedom, which I interpret as the freedom to do the right thing, the freedom to follow through certain moral principles. And that sort of moral freedom is connected to dignity and is what gives dignity to humans. And it's what makes dignity quintessentially human. But of course, this is a sort of philosophical discussion. On the other hand, what we see, and so for me, on the one hand, philosophically, it's a sort of property that it's not something you can ever lose, because it just is what it means to be human, is to be someone who has this capacity for moral agency, who has this dignity just as part of who they are. But then on the other hand, what we see is dignity constantly tested historically and in different political circumstances. And this capacity for moral agency that we have is always also challenged and sometimes isn't fully realized because of the circumstances in which we act, because of the compromises that we have to make, because of the political systems in which we find ourselves having to make certain choices. So the book really is an effort to, on the one hand, think philosophically about this property that we all have, but on the other hand, to also think through historically and politically about what it means for dignity to be assaulted and affronted and what a cost of protecting it is in these tragic circumstances.
Yes, and that makes me think, for example, of the photographs that we all saw of Abu Ghraib in Iraq. You know, how those who are in position of abusive authority immediately attack the dignity of those who are in their thrall, either by controlling how they move, robbing them of their ability to move, or putting them in circumstances, as they did there, of forcing them to wear women's underwear on their head and things of that kind. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that aspect of robbing. You know, how do authoritarian regimes, fascist regimes, rob people of their dignity?
Yeah, I think it's the first effort at dehumanizing someone is exactly this attempt to rob people of dignity by making them seem less human, or by putting them in a position where we can't look at them without feeling this sense of moral apprehension. And I think it's something that, on the one hand, as I say, it's always an effort, because however much you put someone in a position like that, we know that being human is still having this capacity for dignity. But on the other hand, a person who has been in this position of being dehumanized can't rely just on themselves to stand up to this and to resist and to affront, to rise to this challenge. And that's why, for me, rescuing dignity or defending dignity isn't just the responsibility of the single agent who's been dehumanized. It raises the question of collective responsibility, and it raises the question of what does an alternative account of dignity look like, and how do we rescue dignity, and how do we resist these efforts at dehumanization, which my book does at the level of form. It does by, on the one hand, raising the question of how authorities always try to rob people of dignity, and how exercising power is just this effort to impose a particular outlook on dignity on agents. And on the other hand, what is the role of art and literature and using the imagination to think about a counterfactual world in which dignity flourishes, and how do they fight this effort of authorities and of power to rob people of their dignity, and how do they contribute to this collective resistance?
That's wonderful. And, you know, going on the side of dignity, it strikes me also that the new mayor of New York, Mayor Zohra Mamdani, speaks so much about dignity in a different way than you do. He talks about the ability to afford a decent life is the ability to afford a dignified life.
Yeah, and I think those two views of dignity are connected, because I think to be able to have moral agency, to be able to exercise this moral freedom that we all have, you also have to be in a situation, in circumstances, where you can be an author of your life. But if you're dependent on other people for your work or for your livelihood, or if you're at the mercy of the power of others and you're constantly at the mercy of manipulation or being shaped by these outside forces, then you don't have this capacity. Your autonomy is being threatened. So I think of those as actually as projects that are connected. And I think there's a reason why this language of dignity resonates so much, because it's a universal language. It's one that you can grasp from different religious backgrounds, from different cultures, from different ethnicities. It's a kind of universal property that all humans have, and it really resists particularization and reduction to particular identities.
And we are talking with Leah Upi about her book, Indignity, A Life Reimagined. It is part history, part memoir, and part novel. And so I want to ask you about that aspect of this book. The book moves between archives that you explored and imagination, between fact and fiction, and between present and past, in the sense that it's a memoir and a history. And so I wanted to ask you, how do you balance historical fact with your imaginative reconstruction? What were the constraints you felt? And what was the purpose of doing it the way you did?
Yeah, perhaps I start with the latter, because it's connected to this the genesis of the book, which was this photograph that was shared on social media. And I discovered that the photograph, the original, might be held in this archive of former Secret Service authorities in Albania, where all the surveillance documents of the victims of the communist regime are held. And so I went, and the project began really as a straightforward nonfiction project of trying to recover the truth of my grandmother's life after having placed an application and had access to these documents and entered this archive with the idea that by uncovering the documents and by uncovering what was in those files, I would also somehow find the truth about my grandmother's life. But the first thing you realize, if you actually enter the archive and if you have access to these files, is that you can only trust the truth of those files if you trust the perspective from which the file has been created, if you trust the authority that has compiled the facts in a certain way and ordered them and presented them to you. And very soon I realized that not just in communist Albanian archives, but even in, because part of my grandmother's life was in Greece and a part of it was in Italy, even in these other countries, in every archive there was a standpoint that shaped the facts in a way that would match the narrative of that institution, of that authority, of that power structure, and reflect that narrative, whether it was a class struggle and communists in Albania, whether it's nationalism in Greece, or whether it's paternalism. Researching the life of the woman is even harder because of all these different layers coming together. And that made me realize that you can, of course, construct a story based on the facts, but what you also have to think about is what the archive is not telling you. What are the silences there? What is it, the things that you cannot get access to because they've been deliberately excluded by the sources? And of course, this is then turning to literature. That's the point where I thought that perhaps there is a way of trying to give voice to these silences, of trying to reconstruct the facts that are missing by doing a different kind of research, that is the research of a fiction writer, that is also based on sources, but without the search for coherence and the search for coherence in the life of one person, but rather bringing together these different sources and making them the material for a fictional, imaginative reconstruction of the context in which this life emerged, the historic forces that constrained it, and giving kind of detail that only literature can give, but with that detail also filling in the gaps of history. So it becomes really this effort to kind of merge historical inquiry with literary imagination is really one way of thinking about the continuity of literature and history, and of history and literature, and of what kind of work one can do counterfactually in thinking critically about sources and about just truth as reliant on the facts that are ordered by these institutions and by these archives.
Wow, there's a lot there. Could you unpack that a little bit more for us? I mean, what was that process like for you in creating, in imagining, reimagining your grandmother's life?
So one of the interesting things that came with then making the jump to literature is if you're just investigating a woman's life as I did, and this woman is your grandmother and you're related to her in this very specific way, then only the information that relates to this life of this woman that is given to you by the archive is relevant, and everything else you have to discard and think it's not, you know, it doesn't inform my inquiry and I don't need to write about it and somehow I have to exclude it. But on the other hand, if you approach the material as a literary writer, as a fiction writer, then of course it's about your grandmother, but it's also about a more generic character, about someone who lives in this space and time with these character features, that is in conversation with different actors in that context. And the fictional enterprise becomes one way through which one can reconstruct all of that by having access through the sources to other lives that weren't necessarily immediately connected to my grandmother, but that were also relevant to inform the inquiry. So, for example, if I set out to write about Salonika in the 1930s, if I just research my grandmother, the information is limited. But if I think about what was it like to be a woman in this man's environment in a city that was very cosmopolitan and then became hostage to these emerging nationalist forces that suffered through these upheavals of first the financial crisis, then World War II, then eventually migration to Albania, then those lives are there. And even though they're not lives that I have met personally or that I have a connection, an emotional connection because I'm a relative or an ancestor, they are still important lives to write about when you think about dignity in a more philosophical perspective. And if you think about the role of literature in reconstructing a life with dignity, regardless of whether you have a particular connection to that life or not. And so it seems to me that their literature becomes a vehicle and a tool for reconstructing a sort of more generic character and also with a different approach to this reality of the 20th century.
I have done a lot of research into my father's history during World War II, and as part of it, I came across a memoir of somebody who died was later to die. In fact, not too long before he was taken by the Germans and died in a concentration camp, a Nazi concentration camp. And he writes in this diary that all history is a dialogue between the living and the dead. And it seems to me that you had that dialogue with your grandmother. Is that so? Is that something that you felt? And if so, what did your grandmother say to you?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very much a dialogue. And it was also a dialogue that was happening with a kind of mindfulness to how does one get a balanced perspective in this dialogue. So how do we, because I think actually all culture is in a way a dialogue between the living and the dead, but often a lot of culture is also a manipulation of the dead, is a kind of ferrying them into our world for our own purposes and for reasons and in ways that perhaps the people who are no longer there don't understand, don't necessarily approve of. And they have no longer a voice. And so it's up to us to think about the authority with which we reconstruct those perspectives. So I was very mindful of this, because once you become mindful of the fact that there is ideology and there's propaganda and there's power that shapes your approach to the past, then of course you think about your own bias and the ways in which your own perspective might be manipulated or might be the result of some standpoint in the present that a previous generation wouldn't be able to recognize as such. So I was very careful, and I was very sensitive to this question. On the one hand, as I say, the fact that it was unavoidable to bring my own perspective to the point where I wondered, is my grandmother actually what my grandmother was to herself, or is she what I am wanting her to be and what I am projecting into her and what I am thinking she's saying to me about that particular context that I read with the eyes of my own context? Or what is the way through which I can try to bring as much of her voice, as much of her perspective as possible? And I try to do that by reconstructing and by being really detailed about the context in which she lived, the city in which she spent her childhood, the kind of country where she moved when she moved to Albania from Greece in the 1930s, and doing as much of giving detail and giving color and giving nuance and giving perceptions of her contemporaries. And as I said, dialogues and dilemmas from a point of view and from a perspective that I think only literature offers, because only literature gives you the ability to go inside the mind and inside the context of someone who is no longer there. And that's why I think my dialogue with my grandmother in the end was really, on the one hand, shaped by my own philosophical questions, by my own concern with what dignity is and how do we defend dignity at a kind of time of extremes and when it's most challenged, And the question that I also had, which is, what do we do when our own standpoint, the standpoint of the present, is also being doubted from a moral perspective? And on the other hand, the kinds of tools that literature gives you to think about that life in her own context. And that's why it's very much a dialogue between, as I say, the authors and the writers and my own philosophical concerns, and then what the literature can give you as material that continues by inhabiting the lives of others and the minds of others.
And Leah Upi, I can hear my listeners saying to me now, tell us more about Liman, the author's grandmother, and her relationship to her. So let's move a little bit more just to the personal. What kind of grandmother was she to you in your childhood? And fill us in a little bit about her background.
Yeah, so I grew up in communist Albania and experienced a transition to capitalism in the 90s. And my grandmother was the main reference point in my life. She was the kind of person that I turned to for help and for navigating this time of transition and this time of great confusion that I lived. And she herself had also lived through transition. She was born in 1918 in Thessaloniki, in contemporary Greece, at a time when the Ottoman Empire was still around. She was born to her Albanian aristocratic family, which was part of the Ottoman Empire elite. And the fortunes of her family changed with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And Salonika, the city of birth, went from being a cosmopolitan, multicultural, important commercial and diplomatic center of the Ottoman Empire, but then of modern Greece, into a city that was more and more shaped by the nationalist forces that began to change Europe in the 1920s and 30s. So she grew up in Thessaloniki in this very cosmopolitan environment. She spoke French. She also spoke French to me when I was a child, because that was really her identity, was a kind of class identity rather than a particular nationality identity. And she then moved to Albania because minorities in Thessaloniki were very much under pressure. And there she met my grandfather, who was coming from a similar background. And he was a socialist, but he was the son of a prominent conservative politician. And after the war, when the communists came to power, they arrested him because he'd been part of a different social democratic movement. And she became the wife of a political prisoner and a single mother to my father. So she had this life of, as I say, being born in great privilege and wealth and then decline, and also a life in which she experienced everything from the collapse of empires to the rise of nationalism to then fascism, Nazism, World War II, communism. And then also she survived the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of communism and the triumph of neoliberalism. She died in 2006. So she was a very important figure to me, both because of the proximity and because of the role she played and because she was my main caretaker. I grew up with her. She taught me everything. She was someone that was a sort of source of wisdom and advice. But also in the book, she plays also another role, which is to embody this life that is shaped by the forces of the 20th century, and that raises the question of what does it mean for someone who is grown in a context like that, in an environment like that, to live with dignity, and what is the cost of protecting her dignity, and what is the obligation of someone who survives her to then tell the story of this life, that is the story of a life that's both very close to me and also a life that I talk about for these philosophical, political reasons. What is the way in which one can do that with integrity and in a way that sort of does justice to this dignity of this person?
When you began this research, I mean, you had to apply to the archives in Tirana. And you applied as a researcher, not as a family member. If you had applied as a family member, which one of the staff there told you several times, you wouldn't have to pay for copies of the material. So why did you apply as a researcher?
I did it because I was, on the one hand, just scared and afraid of the burden of the past. I was very aware of the fact that many people in former communist countries go to the archives thinking that they will find the history of a family relative that they think of as a victim. And then they discover that actually the victim is a perpetrator, and suddenly this image of the person that is very close to you that you might have as a kind of moral saint turns out to be completely overnight changed, and the person that is no longer a hero but becomes, as I say, someone who has actually oppressed other people, who has collaborated themselves, who's been contributing to state surveillance. This is a very common story. And somehow I was very mindful and very worried about this, and because I was so close to my grandmother, I was also really afraid of what I would find about her and of the fact that there might be a complete disjunction between the old woman that I met and I loved and the person whose past I had no idea about, because it was all contained in this archive. And somehow applying as a researcher and not as a family member helped me put a boundary between me and this life that I would uncover in the archive. And somehow I think helped me control my fear about what I would find and also think differently about my responsibility, because then the responsibility becomes the responsibility of the researcher to reconstruct and to explain the historical forces in as much integrity as they can, but isn't really the same as the responsibility of a family member, of a relative. And in my case, of a granddaughter whose identity is in many ways shaped by the grandmother, by who she was. And so it became a very existential question, you know, how you approach the archive. And that's why I decided to have this distance between me and the documents.
And you go a little further than just that apprehension in your book. There's a really striking passage on page 21, and I'm going to read it and then ask you to explain it a bit more. And this is at the point where you are thinking about what is your answer to the staff in the archive who's asking, are you applying as a family member or a researcher, or did you apply as a family member or a researcher? You say, I prefer to think of myself as an impartial spectator, an archaeologist in the temple of mutilated knowledge, a shaman leaning over a rotting corpse. I want to tread carefully in the archive. I want to approach those files philosophically, even aesthetically, in a manner intentionally different from that of the, quote, legislation in force.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was where I was trying to foreshadow a little bit the method of the book and the reasons I had for thinking about the relationship between morality and beauty, and so ethics and aesthetics, which is one of the themes of the book as well from a philosophical perspective, whereby the dominant approach in a number of contexts where this question of how do we navigate historical injustice, how do we think about the sources of historical facts, is to think that, with some naivety, that if you only get access to the files and to the truth of someone's life, that will help you reconcile yourself with the injustice that was done in the past, that will help somehow bring the truth to light. And of course, one of the things that, as I said earlier, for me was very clear from the start, is that you can only trust the truth if you can trust the perspective from which the truth is reconstructed. And that the archive is the perspective of power, is the perspective of an institution that orders knowledge in a particular way. It's a kind of, it's archive, but it's something to do with, this is why I mentioned the word, with the archaeology of knowledge, because the archive is the first kind of ordering principle of history in many ways. And I thought that I didn't want to approach the archive just as a historian, just as someone who thought about what truth you find. I wanted to also inquire and question the truth, and also question the perspective from which the truth was being reconstructed. And for that, I felt that I needed a different standpoint, not just the standpoint of someone who takes the authority for granted and goes into the archive and works with whatever sources they find from this authority, but actually questions the authority and raises critical questions, and questions it also from a moral perspective by asking, okay, whose voice are you not including? Whose perceptions, whose lived experience is being deliberately neglected by the way in which these sources are being put together? And there, as I say, the sort of the aesthetic, that's why the aesthetic word is mentioned, the approach becomes one where you're trying to approach the archive like an artist, like someone who asks critical questions, like someone who deliberately always refuses to be shaped by power and in fact always interacts with power in a critical way.
And when we think about refusing to be shaped by power, your grandmother lived in a state of pervasive police surveillance, secret police surveillance, in fact. We live in an age of, you know, surveillance capitalism. We live in an age where surveillance is pervasive everywhere and in many ways is actually shaping us, not just surveilling us, but actually shaping us. I wonder if you could talk about How do we maintain our dignity, our aesthetic, our questioning in a world where the intensity of the surveillance is so intimate?
Yeah, for me, this question also came up when I was looking at the files of my grandmother, where sometimes I found myself thinking, okay, what would my life look like to someone who goes a few generations after and tries to reconstruct it based on the online trails, on the digital data that there are about me everywhere? And of course, there, the question of power is interesting because you don't have, as in analog surveillance in communist states, an authority that is trying to manipulate, that is deliberately surveilling with an intention of ruining someone's life or with spying on their motives. It's not this kind of vertical exercise of power, but what you have is a more horizontal, more diffuse way in which surveillance works by complicity, sometimes with people not minding sharing their data, where, you know, you become a vehicle, a cog in this kind of machine that's much more complicated and that goes way beyond how one might have interpreted the surveillance machine of a communist state, but that's also pervasive and in many ways also an affront to dignity. And for me, the first step to thinking is to actually to have critical awareness about this. Sometimes I feel in our society, we often not even aware that there is surveillance that is an affront to dignity. We think, oh yeah, but it's, you know, it's not, it's harmless. It's just some company. That's how they do their business. They use our data. They generate income. Maybe the income gets shared in a certain way. Maybe it trickles down to us. And I think without actually explicitly questioning what this does to human dignity, what it does to our autonomy, what it does to our capacity to set our own ends for ourselves, I think we lose something very, very important. And for me, there isn't really one answer to the question of how does one rescue dignity? How does one recover? But surely the starting point must be having this awareness of being in a system that also somehow undermines it, that raising the critical voice, and also then thinking about the plurality of perspectives from which one needs to approach this question, needs to reconstruct data. And so refusing to be reduced to one way of telling the story or of one way of one authority that we think we trust and then no longer asking questions about that authority. So for me, a lot of it really goes to the core of what is humanity? How do we think reflexively? How do we set ourselves apart from the environment? How do we question the environment? And how do we somehow develop the critical skills and develop a kind of awareness of who we are that is not reducible to what some power structure or other tries to do with us?
Actually, we're in a situation where the capitalist motive for surveillance is increasingly bleeding into the state control motive for surveillance, certainly in this country, in the United States. And I don't think it's probably that far different in Britain, but certainly here, the very people who have created surveillance capitalism are working with the U.S. government and the U.S. military and police and paramilitary in order to surveil everything in our lives, not just for selling ads, but for more nefarious purposes.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. And it also raises the question of why it's so important to think of times when history repeats itself and to be mindful of the dynamics in which history repeats itself before things get completely out of control and before it's too late to do anything about it. I find this overlaps and these ways in which the past returns really eerie, not just when it comes to surveillance, but also, for example, when it comes to the way in which identity and cultural belonging is being weaponized and the way in which nationalist forces try to use this question of do you belong, do you not belong, and put it at the service of their own projects. And this is, again, something that when I was reading and researching my grandmother's life, this was very much one of the defining features of the 1920s and 30s, where you have these authoritarian movements that begin to emerge, but they don't all emerge as, you know, Nazis in the way we now think of the Nazis. They began to emerge as projects of telling a group, well, your plight, your suffering, your injustice is the responsibility of this other group. And so in this drawing boundaries between us and them for motives that at the beginning aren't as objectionable as we might think. It's about, you know, places for doctors and lawyers, for example, or whether we should have restrictions for certain categories of people. And so in ways that are really very opaque to begin with and not immediate immediately, we don't see the harm immediately. But then what we see is that if you're not vigilant and if you're not constantly mindful of this question of dignity, a few years down the line, then the situation has really deteriorated and then it's become too late to react. So I think a lot of the conversations in the book, both about surveillance and also about the nationalism and the connection between nationalism and fascism, and the slow deterioration of a society into full-blown fascism, are there also to think about what lessons can we learn from history and how can we avoid history repeating itself and how can we become more vigilant so that we can see when things are about to get out of control before they're completely out of control and before it's too late and nobody can do anything.
And of course, that's a question. And when is it too late? I mean, I think many people in the United States are waking up and asking themselves, I certainly am, is it already too late? So, yeah, let's talk about how people can keep their moral compass when history is stacking up against them. And let's start with your grandmother, her choices, Lehmann's choices. What do you think allowed her to resist being absorbed by the system? And what can we learn from that?
I think maybe it was a kind of faith in humanity that we need to keep even when it looks like it's unwarranted. One of the first moments you were asking earlier, is it too late? I think it's really important to keep telling yourself that it's never too late because we are free human beings that shape the world. It's not just shaped for us. We have agency, we have political capacities, we have capacities to kind of come together and respond and resist. And I think this is why it's so important to have this conversation around dignity as a universal feature and also dignity as a property that is always there and can never be fully taken away from you, because it enables you to not be completely pessimistic and not be completely catastrophic about the resources that humans have to resist compromises, to resist this manipulation, and creates this kind of urge to go out together and to find the solutions. I think it's also really important to resist both in a way, both dogmatism and skepticism. So this idea that there are solutions out there, there may not be one solution, there may not be one political force that has it, but if people are broadly understanding and they have the right diagnosis and they have the capacity to engage with the present in the right way, then they can come together and they can resist. So on the one hand, this effort to resist the dogma of authority, and on the other hand, it's also really important to resist skepticism and pessimism and this nihilism that in the end makes you give up prematurely and makes you want to say, well, now it's already too late, or we can't do anything, or we better look elsewhere, or we better just go inwards and be with ourselves without thinking about solidarity or without thinking about how the plight of someone that an immigrant out there who I might feel I have no connection to, how that is actually really important to my humanity as well. It's not just their concern, it's also mine. So I think in her case, it was very difficult. And a lot of the book really is about how difficult all of that is and how you just saying it is much easier than actually doing it, because then there is a cost and there's often a tragic cost to resisting compromise. But I think it's also in many ways a hopeful take for a dystopian scenario, not too unlike the one in which we live, where it's always a reminder that there is humanity and that one mustn't give up on humanity.
Well, this is just a wonderful read, a wonderful book, Indignity, A Life Reimagined, and it's been great to talk with you about it, Leah Uppi. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Leah Uppi. Read an excerpt from Indignity by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, a powerful story of exile, love, and the price of freedom. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Today on Writer's Voice, we're talking about freedom, exile, and what it means to survive with one's integrity intact. Eleanor Shearer's new novel, Fireflies in Winter, follows her protagonist, Cora, a Jamaican Maroon woman forcibly exiled to Nova Scotia at the end of the 18th century. Cora has never been enslaved, yet her freedom is deeply precarious. In Nova Scotia, she encounters Agnes, a formerly enslaved woman surviving free in the forest, and also Thursday, an indentured laborer whose freedom hangs by a thread. In a frozen colonial landscape, Cora has to navigate grief, displacement, and impossible moral choices. It's a novel about the ambiguity between legal and lived freedom and the moral collision between survival and solidarity. And it's a queer love story about two women who insist on making their own choices within a system that is intent on restraining them. Let's listen now. Eleanor Shearer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
At its heart, Fireflies in Winter is a historical novel really about displacement, survival, and the cost of freedom in a society that is based on slavery. Your protagonist is Cora, a Jamaican Maroon woman who was forcibly exiled to Nova Scotia after the Second Maroon War. First, tell us a little bit about the history that sets the stage for this novel.
Yeah, Jamaica Maroons were a fascinating community in Jamaica that does have so much to do with those questions of what does freedom really mean and how far would you go to take it? So the island of Jamaica, pretty mountainous, favourable terrain for runaways right from the earliest days of transatlantic enslavement. And some of the communities in the mountains were so strong in their resistance to the British that after a few generations in the early 18th century, the British said, we know we're never going to be able to fully defeat you militarily. And it's costing us so much in terms of raids on the plantations, destruction of the sugarcane, that we're willing to do a deal with you. So for a few of these communities scattered across the island, they sign a treaty that says we will give you freedom, we will give you land to settle on, but in exchange, you effectively act as enforcers of the plantation system. You have to patrol, you capture runaways, return them. There are a few slave uprisings in Jamaican history that the Maroons helped suppress. And then there's a group of them, the Trelawney Town Maroons, that in the 1790s do rebel again against the British. They feel like there are still some elements of their freedom that are constrained, maybe more concessions that they can get. But that rebellion is brutally suppressed. And this is the time in the Caribbean of the Haitian Revolution. So the British are very nervous about any kind of uprisings in the island. So once they destroy the revolt of the Trelawney Town Maroons, they ship them off to Nova Scotia. And that's how my protagonist Cora ends up going from this tropical island, that's all she's ever known, that's where she's born, to this very cold, frozen, forbidding and unfamiliar landscape in Nova Scotia.
And I want to just ask you briefly a little bit about your own background. Your family came from the West Indies to Britain. Did they have any connection to any of this resistance history? Or was the very fact of them coming to England part of that?
So my grandparents were from Barbados and St. Lucia. There is, across the Caribbean, traditions of resistance and running away from plantations that go beyond just Jamaica. So although the Jamaican Maroons were almost unique in having that formal guarantee of freedom by the British, I know that one of the times I was in St. Lucia visiting my mother's cousins, they spoke so proudly about the fact that the family lives on land that would have been used by runaway slaves, so Maroons in St. Lucia, to fight against the white plantation owners. So I've always been fascinated because of my family's history and background in stories of resistance to slavery in all its forms, from the smallest act of an individual running away through to these large armed uprisings like the Haitian Revolution. And then my grandparents' journey to the UK, that was in the 1950s. They were part of what's called the Windrush generation. So there was a big migration to the UK after the Second World War. And I do think that kind of planted the seeds for, I came across the story of the Jamaica Maroons in some research I was doing about slavery in the British Empire. And probably what drew me to the story was that fascination with what is it like to go from a warm place to a cold one, weather and environment as part of the migration story, as part of the fact that you're uprooted, you're so far from everything you know. For my grandparents, you know, they looked different racially to everyone they encountered in the UK, being black. But there's also on top of that, the weather. There's the fact that my grandmother had never seen fog before she came to London. I just grew up with these stories about that kind of environmental transition that I think
made me start to wonder, wow, in the 1790s, with an even bigger temperature differential between Jamaica and Canada, what must that have been like for these Maroons?
Exactly. It opens in a frigid Nova Scotia in the depths of winter. There are three central characters. Tell us first about your protagonist, Cora, with whom the novel opens, and then we'll talk about Agnes and Thursday. All of them, though, inhabit a place that is ambiguous in a society that's sharply divided between those who are free and those who are enslaved.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the ambiguity, because it's something in my work I'm always interested in exploring. The 1790s is a period where slavery is legal in much of the Americas, but there's always this gap between sort of legal freedom and legal slavery, just in terms of you might be free on paper, but do you have the security, the resources to live your life as you see fit? And so Nova Scotia is a place that slavery is still legal there, but it has this large free Black community that comes from the United States, because during the War of Independence, the British agreed to free any enslaved people who deserted their plantations and came to fight. When the British lost, they took many of those people with them to Nova Scotia to resettle them so that their freedom could be protected. All of this is to say that there's a background of what does it really mean to be free, gradations in levels of freedom between my different characters. And Cora is interesting because she is part of the Maroon community. And I think I've explained a little bit about the background of these people, but often when people hear Maroons, runaway slaves, they really do think this is someone who would have been born on a plantation and then ended up winning their freedom. But that wasn't the case for the Jamaican Maroons, because they had this settlement with the British. Over multiple generations, people would have been born in the Maroon settlements and never have known slavery. And so I was interested to start out with a character who, she is a Jamaican woman, she is Black, she's in a particular time period where you think that she would necessarily have experienced slavery, but actually she hasn't. And what does that do to her view of the world? What does that do to her encounters with people who have been enslaved? I think as someone to really represent the themes of the novel, grappling with those issues around what it really means to be free, it made sense to me to kind of focus in on her as someone who actually has never been enslaved.
So let's talk more about what it means to be free in this beautifully written novel, Fireflies in Winter, Eleanor Shearer. I'd like to come back to Cora, but first, the novel repeatedly dismantles, I think, romantic notions of liberation. So what does free, just kind of with a big picture, what does free mean inside of colonial systems that are designed to deny it? And how does the community in Nova Scotia live in a fragile balance between being dependent on colonial authorities and feeling resentment and resistance to it? So kind of big picture and then down to the community here.
Yeah, I think big picture, questions of freedom in this time period, especially for Black people, you're always grappling with the tension between freedom and constraint. So even for people that are free, born free, made free, even after the end of the abolition of slavery itself, there are still going to be so many constraints on your action as a Black person in the world. So you will never experience the perfect freedom of just being able to live your life however you see fit, you know, make life plans and pursue them, because you will always be coming up against deep economic restrictions. You'll always be coming up against pervasive racism and oppression. So there's that kind of thing bearing down and limiting people's freedom. But I also always want to show in my work that those systems of constraint can never fully crush the human spirit and never fully snuff out forms of resistance and agency that amount to freedom, even in the kind of darkest moments and even in the depths of plantations and brutality. There were always ways in which people carved out space for themselves. And in this novel, and also in my previous novel, River Sing Me Home, which is about a mother looking for her children after emancipation, I return again and again to love as one of those ways of carving out space, of one of those ways of being free. And love is in itself an expression of the tension between freedom and constraint, because in some ways, that ability to love who you want to love, especially this novel, a queer love story, but Black love in a time of enslavement, when one of the things slavery was setting out to do was destroy people's families, destroy relationships. It would routinely rip people away from each other and you'd never see those family members or loved ones again. being able to continue loving is a form of resistance to that system. But at the same time, love is itself a constraint. Everyone knows the fact that to love someone, to bind yourself to them, to commit to them, does involve, you know, growing, changing, shaping yourself around them in some ways. And so to me, love and freedom, two of the big themes in the novel, are very deeply intertwined. And then to go down to the specifics of the community, Cora's community, I mentioned how in Jamaica they occupy this interesting legal space between slave and free, because they're dependent on the British for this guarantee of their freedom, but as a result they're kind of elevated above enslaved people and they're not subject to the same conditions as people working on the plantations. In Nova Scotia, they similarly, compared to the African-American communities they would have been surrounded by, these are people who came over from the United States with little to nothing and then were offered pretty much nothing in terms of support from the British colonial government when they were settling. Those first few winters that the African-American loyalists would have experienced would have been utterly punishing, and the British government was sending kind of men and materials to build new homes to all of the white loyalists who had resettled from America after the War of Independence. And so you often had black people living effectively in kind of holes in the ground covered by a tent, and many of them forced to enter into indentured contracts to essentially sell their freedom, sell their labor for a fixed period of time just to be able to survive. The Jamaica Maroons are not like that. They are given land to settle on by the governor of Nova Scotia. They're given food and provisions. There's talk of them taking on a role in the armies of Canada. So again, they have these forms of privilege, but then at the same time, they are subject to constraint. They don't want to be in Nova Scotia. There's a fantastic quote from one of their petitions to be sent back either to Jamaica or to some other place, where they say, "The Jamaican cannot flourish where the pineapple is not." You know, they don't want to be in this deeply freezing and forbidding place. And initially their petitions go unanswered. So they are also, on the micro level, that community, dealing with this constant interplay between freedom and constraint.
Did they eventually go back?
No, what happened was they and many of the African-American loyalists end up in Freetown in Sierra Leone. So this was a colony in West Africa that had been founded by white British abolitionists in the late 18th century after the end of slavery. So slavery is sort of effectively abolished in the UK within the kind of borders of the British Isles, long before the abolition of slavery in the colonies. And so there are many people who, black people who had been brought over by masters or mistresses from the Caribbean, ended up in the UK, often in London, whether they'd run away or they'd been able to win legal freedom. They again had very little in terms of being able to work or attract resources for themselves. So they're impoverished on the streets of London. The abolitionists want to do something about this problem, and their idea is, why don't we send them back to Africa, despite this being a place that, you know, most of the black Caribbean people in London would never have been. They said, why don't we set up this colony? We can send these formerly enslaved people to Freetown, and they can show by growing crops and trading with the British that West Africa doesn't need slavery and the trade in enslaved people to survive. So that's how Freetown gets started. And then these white abolitionists travel to Nova Scotia and first appeal to the African-American loyalists, many of whom travel over as well. And then the Jamaicans are eventually sent over to Freetown in Sierra Leone, where most of them settle.
It's a fascinating history. Now, you mentioned love and you also mentioned indentured servitude. So tell us briefly about the two other major characters in this book. Tell us about Agnes and then Thursday.
So Agnes and Thursday both have common roots in the American South. They are part of this movement of African-American loyalists after the American Revolution. Agnes is when Cora arrives in Nova Scotia and she's going walking out in the wilderness, in the forest, and begins to see this mysterious figure out there surviving by themselves. That turns out to be Agnes. So when Cora meets Agnes and gradually gets drawn into her world of sort of surviving in nature and knowing what plants to forage, how to hunt, how to build wigwams for herself, she's learned skills from the Mi'kmaq Indians, the first Canadian people that would have been in Nova Scotia at the time. The big mystery for Cora is, you know, what is Agnes running from? Why has she ended up out here by herself? And that's a story and a secret that the novel explores. So In terms of Cora and Agnes, I think that one of the things that's so powerful about a love story, especially a queer love story, is having these two characters that you set side by side and say you have similarities and overlaps that draw you to each other, but you also have differences that you have to navigate in your relationship. So the fact that Agnes is someone who has been enslaved where Cora has not, that affects the way that she moves through the world. That is kind of a way that their relationship really manifests the theme of freedom in the book. And then you have Thursday. So he is an indentured labourer nearby to where Cora and the Maroons have settled, that Cora meets and develops a friendship with. And he is someone, his story, without giving too much away, it turns out that he has basically taken on the indentured ship contract of someone else, someone who believed that they were signing a contract for a much shorter period of time than it actually turned out was the case. And this was inspired by when I did my research trips to Nova Scotia and I spent time at the Black Loyalist Heritage Centre there. There are documented cases of Black American loyalists who wouldn't have been able to read or write, and signing these contracts, they were told verbally, were for a few years and could be up to 50 years instead. And so that was just a small way of trying to integrate some of this real history and again show the precarity of freedom for people that you were only ever a kind of set of stolen papers away or one unscrupulous white person away from having your freedom snatched from you. And Thursday is a character who he and Cora develop a close bond. And I did think as I was sort of plotting out and drafting the novel whether I wanted him to almost emerge as an alternative love interest for her. But in the end, I hope he comes across to readers. The intent I wrote him with is that their bond is deeply platonic. And as someone who has some very fulfilling platonic friends with men, that was kind of important for me to reflect. But again, without giving too much away of his backstory, there's a point later in the novel where readers get a bit more insight into maybe what's driving him and what's driving the closeness that he feels to Cora, or why he's drawn to her. And some of the details of his biography and backstory and some of the things that he's endured are very close to my own heart and my own experience. So he's a character that I'm really fond of, even if he's kind of, secondary in the novel to my protagonist, Cora and Agnes.
How is he close to your own heart and experience?
In terms of grief, so the novel is dedicated to my younger sibling, who's called Cal. Cal passed away just over a year ago, aged 25. And in many ways, this is a novel that's kind of shot through with many different aspects of grief. I was working on it when Cal died, and Cora is grieving. She's grieving home. She's grieving a very close friend that she lost in Jamaica during the war. Thursday has his own griefs that shapes his relationship with Cora. Agnes is grieving. She's orphaned like Cora is. So many of these griefs in the novel featured before I lost Cal, but they were kind of sharpened and brought into relief and developed in new ways as I was grappling with grief in my own life.
And Eleanor Shearer in Fireflies in Winter is at the core of this novel, is a moral dilemma. We've talked about different constraints on freedom or contradictions with it, but the moral dilemma is what does it mean to be free when every option costs somebody else, where survival, in fact, collides with morality? I mean, I think that this is a deeply human question in times of crisis, and is certainly at the heart of this book. So, without revealing anything you don't want to, tell us why did you choose to write a novel that was centered on this question of the contradiction between survival and morality?
Yeah, as you say, I think it is a question that transcends time. And my favorite quality about historical fiction as a reader is the fact that you are taken to a time and place that is so unfamiliar. You encounter characters often with worldviews that are not the same as your own, but there will always be that anchor, that way in, that thing that you can kind of hang your sensibilities on as a modern day person and say, I recognize this. And so it then shows you something timeless about what it really means to be human. And I think it's not just, there's something very specific to this place and these communities, whether that's the kind of bargain that the Maroon communities did to guarantee their own freedom that's quite specific to the Jamaican context. But I think that in all contexts, both in terms of the history of slavery and in the history of so many other examples of oppression or colonialism right up to the present day, the issue of how you survive, the question of how collective that survival is versus how selfish, I guess, how much you are looking to sort of protect yourself and your own versus having a more expansive view of what freedom means. I think these are really serious questions that people have always had to grapple with. And I'm aware as I'm saying those words, it sounds like I'm leading towards a particular moral answer. And I think as a political agent, I do feel very strongly about kind of collective action and collective freedom and how important it is for us, especially in dark times like these, not to withdraw into ourselves and to feel like actually our freedom is tied to the freedom of other people, because that's the way that we can ground resistance. But as a novelist, I'm always going to be interested in getting into the heads of people that make all sorts of choices. So I'm kind of not, when I'm creating characters that act out these dilemmas, I'm not interested in just judging and condemning them for what they did, because I think it is intensely human to want to get out at any cost and want to survive at any cost. And exploring the conditions under which people make those sorts of choices and what makes them jump one way or the other is always going to be interesting to me.
And as you say, at the end, the novel resists a tidy resolution. Instead, it seems to more insist on witnessing the responsibility that comes with love, the responsibility that comes with freedom. Why was that important to you rather than, you know, supplying a tidy resolution?
Yeah, because life and particularly history is not very tidy. And, you know, I'm aware, especially when you're writing about queer history, you're always going to open yourself up to charges of anachronism. And sometimes those charges are made, I think, in bad faith by people who act as if queerness was invented in the last 50 years, which it very much wasn't. But sometimes I think readers will genuinely come to a story about the past that features a queer love story and wonder, could these people have been happy? Surely they would have been killed for who they were, or been miserable, or been so oppressed they couldn't have actually found any kind of intimacy or joy. And so I kind of wanted to resist, I guess, the tidy ending of tragedy that says all of your expectations about the past are true and there's no way that people could have loved under these conditions, whether those conditions are enslavement or those conditions are being queer in a time when it wasn't safe to be so. And I think that's a failure of imagination. I think that, as I mentioned, there are always going to be those pockets where people are able to find each other and find love and find some forms of agency. But also, I guess, it feels wrong to have too pat an ending, too neatly tied up, too happily ever after, because that does a disservice to the realities of the time period and the forces that would have been ranged against my protagonists as two queer Black women. So it's always about the delicate threading of the needle between those two paths. You know, you don't just want to show it as unrelentingly bleak. You don't want to show it as all sunshine and roses. And so trying to find the path in between.
And so finally, I want to return to the title, Fireflies in Winter. What do the fireflies signify?
Yeah, they're a thematically resonant animal in the book. There's a few of them. There's the whales as well, which I'm very fond of, a migratory animal that speak to, you know, finding home in different waters. But the fireflies specifically, you know, they're light in the darkness, but also there's the way that they change through the seasons, especially the fact that they lay their larvae before winter, they hibernate during winter, and then they kind of emerge and grow in the spring and summer. This is a wintry cold book, but it's also a seasonal book. It cycles through spring, summer, autumn, and the characters sort of change and grow with the seasons. And so having an animal that did represent that sense of the year always turns, the season always changes, even at the darkest point of the year. I'm sitting in here in the UK where it is already depressingly dark and it feels like you're never going to have long days and warmth and sunlight again, but there is inevitability to the fact that the seasons will change. And so the fireflies stand in for those stories of survival in the natural world that my characters inhabit.
It is really a beautiful book, beautifully written, and it's just been delightful to talk with you, Eleanor Shearer. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Eleanor Shearer. You can listen to or read a sample from Fireflies in Winter by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.